Congratulations.
That was very cool, Bruce.
Putting up with
oh, thanks for doing it. Thank you very much. It's great. It'll get more and more fun. So, good evening. Hello again. We lost one of our Sangha members today, Arthur, the man who has been leading the practice at Hokoji for the last 5 or 6 or 7 years. Wasn't very well when I got there a week ago, and then as the week went by, he just declined and declined. Until he just barely got through his precept ceremony on Sunday morning. And by this afternoon, he was gone. So it was very quick, which means he didn't suffer so much. It was a very strange sesshin, as you can imagine. The Zendo is the garage, or was the garage, for the little house up on the mountain. And, of course, it makes a nice Zendo, but everything else had to happen in the house. So Arthur was in the bedroom, and we were going in and out of the house all the time. We ate in there, and chanted in there, and used the bathroom, and cooked meals and all of that. And he came out now and then and joined us as he could. There were only 2 people who were there for the whole time, so the rest of the community there just sort of drifted in and out. We had a discussion every afternoon, and I left it open for people to bring up whatever they wanted to discuss, and every single day it was about death and dying. Of course, you know, about the Tibetan view of it, and the Bardo, and what does Zen think, and it's such a big question. It's a big question mark. Arthur himself said, "I don't understand anything." He said, I can't practice now. He said, I've got this hard work to do. He was very straight and clear about it. When we did the ceremony, he couldn't walk, much less do bows, and so he sat in a big overstuffed chair, and I sat next to him, and the altar was sort of right here. And at a certain point, I gave him a lit stick of incense that he could offer, and I was going to hold the bowl for him so he could offer the incense. But he took it, and he went and blessed everyone in the room with it. And there must have been 40 people crammed into that little living room. People from the village, people from long ago and far away, all came. And so he took the precepts and put on the rock suit. And then he said, I'm sorry, but I have to go to bed. So we helped him get up and go to bed. It was a most amazing experience. Very, very sad and very inspiring. It made it very clear. I mean, we all talk about death, and we consider it every now and then, of course, and we get close to it now and then, but this was, especially because we were sitting, I think, you get so open and vulnerable, you just, everything is there. So there was a lot of love. A lot of appreciation and gratitude and and grief. His wife, Ginny, who's a very lively lady, she knows a lot, and she kept saying, "It's just now. It's just now. I have to stay right here. I have to stay right now." And she did that. She did that pretty well. I hadn't known this was going to happen, of course, but I had already written on his Rakusu, called him Dharma Mountain. He's a big guy, just a very big guy in so many ways. So Dharma Mountain seemed just right, and then I thought, what kind of poem could I write on it? And finally I wrote just this. And that's what he got. Jane sent me some pictures. She took a lot of photographs, and how do I send those to the website? I could send those to the website if I knew how.
If you have a lot of them, you can put them on a CD. If you select it, probably would be better. Just send them to me via email.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, if there are a few. Even if they're large, you know, a few will work.
Yeah, they're only three or four.
Right.
But they're nice. Yeah. We also did Buddha's birthday, and I was wondering if you all went up to Chikoji for Buddha's birthday. Did you all do that? Nobody went? Did you celebrate it last week here?
We observed it. Donna Lynn had, she did a word search on some newly translated text of Dogen's on Buddha's birthday, and maybe saw the quote she came up with.
Ah.
We talked about the ceremony, and there were some mixed feelings about the ceremony.
What was the mixedness?
It just didn't seem very Zen.
I see.
It seemed like something inserted by the Japanese folk religion or something.
Hmm. Could very well be.
Was it, I think specifically the myth. Well, I mean, the story of Buddha's birth.
Yes.
Oh, that goes all the way back to India.
Right, right.
Yes.
That's what I think is kind of controversial.
Well, that's very Indian. I mean, it's... I mean, I've forgotten exactly. She got impregnated after dreaming of an elephant. And
he steps out.
Yes, yes, yes.
She's standing up when he's born and he walks. I'm the venerated one or something.
I love that story because I think every baby does that. And I think it's just recognizing that each one of us is a ta-da when we arrive in this world. That it's a big deal to get born. And though we can't, you know, actually take seven steps around and point up and down and all that kind of stuff, it's a way of saying each one of us is full of life. And when we come, we say so. We yell. We pee all over the doctor. It's incredible when a baby is born. So full of energy and life. And I think that's what that's about.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but I think there's, in the culture that we we've been with the whole Christ birth and the
Lord, yes.
I think a lot of
yes.
people have... people were talking about, I guess, what they were getting from that culture.
Too much like Easter?
Yeah, it kind of reminded them of what they didn't like about Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a ritual, that's for sure. It's in the Zen tradition, especially for children. So we all do it, of course, and it's especially to remember and actually pray for people who are suffering all over the world. So it's not that it's just splashing a bunch of stuff all over this little statue. It's a way of expressing concern and metta, you know, loving kindness. As you do this little gesture, you're thinking of the ones that you know who are suffering greatly, and then you send that loving kindness out farther and farther into the world. So it has a meaning besides just the gestures. And if you tell it to children that way, they really get it. And we had seven little girls in party dresses with hippie parents. You know, Taos is a very hippie place. So the parents all came in jeans and big old jackets and, you know, and these darling little girls with fluffy hair and these really little dresses, and very serious when they came up and did it. And did the incense, long time, and then they put it, being careful not to burn themselves. It was just, and they really understood what that was. It was for something. And then when they finished and the grown-ups were doing it, somebody came and asked me, "When's the cake and ice cream?" So cute. Yeah.
I'm curious, how did you folks in the Zendo know that the big mountain passed over to the other side? I mean, how did you guys get awareness of this?
Well, he didn't until today.
Oh,
it was today. I just got a phone call before I came here. He was on his way the whole time, but they diagnosed him with pneumonia yesterday, which is the best way for people to go, they say. And I think he had one daughter there already, and the other one was arriving, and I think he probably waited until she came, and then, you know, the family was together.
How old was he?
He was in his 60s. Yes, younger than me. I was kind of annoyed. I mean, it's really not fair. He's too young.
And how did he deal with it? I mean, has he been sick for a while?
He got diagnosed in January. I heard about it from Vanya when I was in Lucerne. And Vanya and I were already trying to figure out who could take over the place when he died, because it was pancreatic cancer. And there's
cancer.
Yes. And the worst kind. I mean, the kind that they just can't fix, really. And he decided to do chemo, and he had a whole chemo thing, and he did a lot of herbal things, and then he had a test a couple of weeks ago to see whether the chemo was working, and it wasn't. And then he was trying to decide when I got there whether he would do another kind of chemo. And then they did a scan, and they found that it was everywhere. So, you know, it was obvious. It was too late. So he sent letters to everybody, telling everybody how it was going and what was happening and what his hopes were, but he was very pragmatic about it, very sensible about it. He said, "Well, I guess I'm going to see Coben sooner than I thought." So, I don't think he really thought he was going to see Coben, but it was his way of talking about the transition. So,
did he mention about how the practice might have helped him in this process?
He said he couldn't sit. He said, I can't join you. I can't sit now. And I said, no, you've got your work cut out for you. And he said, yes. So at the end, he wasn't sitting. He was just doing the work of dying. And he didn't say how much it helped him, but of course it did. And he sat every single morning up there on the mountain. Sometimes somebody would join him. Mostly he did it by himself. He had an incredible practice. So I'm sure it did. He wasn't afraid. He was disappointed, I think. I think he really thought it was too soon. But he didn't fight it or complain at all. At all. He was very kind to himself and to everybody else. And, you know, people would take turns massaging his feet and bringing him something to drink. And so it was a wonderful kind of compassionate practice, too, around it. But it was very hard to keep the sesshin focused at the same time. It just was... a busier time than usual.
Did he ask you any questions?
He asked if I had anything to say to him. And I just encouraged him to do the best he could. He said, I don't understand anything. And I said, I don't either. Such a mystery.
Did he suffer from the cancer? I mean, the chemo itself is not fun.
The chemo was not fun, but the cancer itself was worse. You know, he was in pain. He was taking morphine by the time he died.
So you wonder sometimes if one is going through physical pain, sometimes it leads into mental pain, and sometimes you say, you know, death might be a sweet thing.
Oh, I think so. I'm very glad that he went as quickly as he did, because he was in a lot of pain. And there was morphine was the only way to deal with it, and he didn't like being on morphine. No. He said it blurred his brain. You can't think very well.
But he wasn't afraid.
He wasn't afraid. And he was so eager. All these years, he had, you know, Coben asked him to take the precepts years ago. Mm. And he said, oh, no, I've got my practice, he said. I'm fine. And then somebody suggested it to him about 3 months ago, after he'd been diagnosed. And he said, no. And then he started thinking about it, and he thought, And they volunteered to, the Sangha volunteered to sew the rakasu for him. So everybody sewed on it. And when he received it, he looked at everybody in the crowd and he said, don't wait as long as I did. So I think he was very, very happy to have finally done it. And he knew it all by heart, you know, it was... He insisted on doing it, though. I suggested that we just sort of say something, and that would be enough, because he knows it so well. But he wanted to do it word for word all the way through, even though it was hard for him to speak. And I'm glad he did. Many people were crying.
So, did Jane become ordained?
No, not yet.
Okay. Was Lori there?
Yes.
How was Lori?
Lori is better. I mean, Lori is tooling around in her wheelchair just like she never was sick. That's a little miracle.
Yes.
She was this close to dying, and they just wiped her out.
And with cancer, right?
With cancer, leukemia.
Right.
And they took away all her white blood cells, and she really almost died. And then they brought her back. And it was a long recovery, but she's back home taking care of her little granddaughter. She's changing her life. She said she doesn't want to do the work she was doing before. She's trying to figure out how to do another life than the one that she had before. She has white curly hair now. You know, she lost all her hair, and when it came back, it was white and curly. She says, I look like a grandmother. But she is one, so... So she was there. She didn't, and she doesn't have a lot of energy still, so she couldn't sit the whole session. But she sat a lot of it and cooked a lot of the food. Yeah. Yeah. She would love to come to our session. There's just no way for this wheelchair to work at Jikoji. There's just no way to do it. So that's my story. It's a powerful thing when you face the end.
What do you call it, the end?
Well, it is an end. It is an end to running around on the earth. It's, we say in the Heart Sutra, no old age and death, and also no extinction of them. And in a lot of places, they translate it no extinction of it. That birth and death is one thing. And so on one side, you have birth and birth. Posits death. You can't have one without the other. You can't have death without birth either. You have to get born in order to die. And then, I mean, Arthur was here. He is not longer and no longer here. One of the things you say in a Zen funeral is, we don't know where you came from, and we don't know where you go. Tathagata. That Buddha comes and goes like that. That's what it is. So our deep love and attachment for people makes it very sad for us when people... when our Buddhas, our favorite Buddhas, go. But in the ultimate sense, you're right, there is no death. It's just the whole thing, the whole dynamic, coming and going and coming and going, infinitely, endlessly. But like everything else, it has two sides. When Chogyam Trungpa died, it was during Sesshin at Jikoji, and we went up on the mountain, on the ridge, where you could see the mountains going down to the ocean, and Koban did a little ceremony up there. And the whole time he was chanting, tears were pouring down his face. Chogyam was his favorite, most best friend. And when we walked back down, there was a young guy, a teenager, who walked with me. And he said, that guy, he's not a real Zen master. He said he was crying, like that was a really, you know, un-Zen thing to do. But it's not like that. We thoroughly live and thoroughly die. 100%. And everybody does it differently. We don't know how we're going to do it until the time comes, I think. Everybody has a different way of going.
Can you prepare for it?
Yes. They say Zazen is the best preparation for it. The Tibetans say that their practice is completely and continually about preparing for death. We don't say it so in such an extreme way in Zen, but it is. It is, certainly. If we aren't sitting with some kind of knowledge of death, then we're missing it. We're not that we have to think about it or bring it up in any way, but just the sense of the tenuousness, insecurity of human life, of life itself. You know, it's just like a leaf, it falls right off the tree. And we tend, because our mind works the way it does, we tend to reify, we tend to solidify everything. It becomes an idea, and the idea becomes so real that life seems so fixed, and our own self feels so fixed, that if we don't consider death as we live our life, then we get lost. We live in a dream world. So it's very important.
Almost feels like, you know, like you're going on a trip and you need to prepare for it. You need your passport.
Yes.
You need, you know. They're not going to let you in. So it's like I feel there needs to be some kind of preparation, but yet I don't know where I'm going.
Yes.
So how do you prepare? What do you pack? You pack a sweater, you pack a t-shirt, you know? Or is it not like that?
No, it's a mind thing. We say mind body, but we're a body that is constantly changing, and that we think of in certain ways. And so it's our accepting the truth of the way it is with us. And when Buddha was getting ready to die, his best disciple said to him, "Buddha, you look terrible." And he said, "Your skin was so beautiful and golden, and you were so stood so tall and so beautifully carried yourself." He said, "What happened?" And Buddha said, "Haven't I told you all these years that everything comes apart? Everything comes apart." He said, "Buddha's come apart too. That put together, it falls apart." He said, "It's no different. No different. We just think that if it's put together, it's going to stick forever. And it doesn't work that way." So it's just becoming more, less and less attached. It's about being able to let go, being able to attach, because attachment is how we love. But being flexible enough to let things go, so that when the time comes, you can kiss yourself goodbye as well. Well, we talked right through Dogen, didn't we?
I was thinking of a question that maybe could have 5 minutes.
Good, good. That's just what we need.
Ritual and mindfulness. It seems that maybe it's kind of. I'm thinking about like last week and discussing Buddha's birthday, and like Buddhism, a lot of people, the first thing they think is mindfulness, but so the ritual, like, and then I think a lot of association with ritual is it's just rote. There's, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Could you maybe talk a little bit about how reconciling the two, or like, I think ultimately, I don't think there's necessarily any kind of conflict there, but.
Well, you're right. I wouldn't say it's a conflict, but there's certainly a difference of opinion about ritual. When I did the Jukai ceremony with Arthur, I felt very honored to be asked to do it. There were a number of people else who could have done it and done it right, done it the regular way, the real ritualistic way. And I was very surprised that he asked me, and then I realized later that he wanted Koban's way. And I do Koban's way, which is some ritual, but not very much. And most people have an enormous lot of ritual built into Zen practice. Much, much more. They do a full moon ceremony that lasts hours. And they do the Buddha's birthday at Green Gulch. It's fabulous. They have flowers everywhere. Just masses and masses of flowers. And tons of little kids. And it's a big party and a big... So, it's considered to be ritual in general, and say at Tassajara, for instance, that is the main training. In a sense, that's even more important than Zazen, because it's a mindfulness training, and it's also a sort of... ego deflation training, just like doing the Doan when you sit there terrified because everybody's going to hear you make the mistake. You know, it's and everything that you do is like that at the monastery. And you make lots of mistakes and it's humiliating, and then you have to get rid of your self-consciousness and just do it, and then you're just doing it, and then, as you say, it can be rote, and the meaning goes out of it. So I think Koban kept trying to keep us fresh and alive with it, so that it still had meaning. When he bowed to his cushion, he really bowed to his cushion. He wasn't just ducking his head. And when he offered incense, he was doing that. But he didn't do a lot of stuff. And he didn't teach us a lot of stuff. But Buddha's birthday was a big deal for him, for the children, because the kids liked it, and because it was about, I don't know, springtime, you know, life. It's been a big sort of question for me, you know, how much to do. And when I go to the teachers' meetings, you know, Carolyn and I and maybe a couple of others are these sort of country cousins who don't have a very strict kind of Zen practice or attitude. It's a little different. So, and I just read an argument about this very thing between a couple of teachers where one was saying, you have to train in the monastery, you can't possibly have even a real Zen experience unless you train in a monastery. And then there's somebody in Japan who's training mostly by email. He even had a sesshin by email, or by, on the web, or he had some sort of web thing going where people could, from all over the world could join the sesshin. So he has a totally different attitude. So it's really up to us to find our way in this and to be open to where we came from. Those old sort of, they look like old-fashioned, old ideas that came from ancient times. They're still with us because they have some value, though it's hard to see sometimes. But there's no reason to hold on to them just because they came from long ago. We have to find our own sense of the value of them. And sometimes it takes a while, sometimes we just don't.
Sometimes, Angie, maybe when we have fun and don't know what to do with it, I would love to go through the dawn thing and know what it means, every brain, why do we ring there, why do we bow, why do you do half a bow?
Yeah.
I remember the first time I came in here and people were walking slowly and then we did this ceremony, then we faced the wall. I said, I'm never coming back.
Here you are.
That's the first thing I thought. Everybody does this and then does this and you bow together. And
yeah.
You
do
that. So it would be nice to know. It's not that important, but it would be nice.
Well, we can do it.
Time comes.
We can do it next week. Let's
I
do
it. I don't know if it has a lot of meaning, but whatever it has, it would be nice to know.
Yeah, it's very practical, actually. All the little noises that are made in Zen are all very practical.
And the makugi or two that we dropped.
Yes, yes. We could do that again if we wanted to, too. We chanted the Heart Sutra with a Mokugyo at Hokoji this week. And it was nice. It was kind of mechanical. Avalokiteshvara. But it's kind of nice, too. And we did the Enmei Juku Kanon Gyo for Arthur 7 times. And it gets faster and faster. And with a Mokugyo, that's really cool. You start up very slow and then it gets faster, 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 faster until you really don't. You have to forget yourself. A lot of it is about forgetting yourself, dropping self-consciousness and just being. Yeah, let's do that next week. We can talk about form. Mm-hmm. That's a very cool idea. Well, thank you all.